Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here. We're going to go ahead and start with public hearing on Senate Bill 931. That's for the purpose of taking Judge Sinache's testimony. He's on hold at this point. I know he has judicial commitments this morning. So let me just check. Judge Sinache, Floyd Przanski, I want to check in to make sure you can hear me, but it looks like we're not even sure if I'm hooked up here.
I'm here.
Oh, excellent, Charlie. All right, so if you would give us your name for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony, since you have posted, or at least I believe it's been posted, your testimony, you don't need to read it in verbatim, but if you can at least give us the highlights and points that you want to emphasize, that would be great.
Certainly. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for accommodating my testimony by telephone. I'm Charles Sinache, spelled C-H-A-R-L-E-S. Last name is Z-E-N-N-A-C-H-E. I'm a circuit judge, court judge here in Lane County. I need to make clear to you that the views I am expressing are my own, and I don't speak upon on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. The bill that you have before you, Senate Bill 931, allows a trial judge the authority to substitute an alternate juror for a juror who dies, becomes ill, or otherwise is unable to complete their deliberations. That this proposed change mirrors changes that were made to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure and have been in effect in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure in civil cases for over 3 years now. The bill that you have before you was actually part of a prior bill that was introduced in the 2013 legislative session. That prior bill was Senate Bill 798. That bill actually had two components to it. The first component was to modify an Oregon statute to allow trial judges discretion over how alternate jurors are selected in criminal cases. In criminal cases, the statute, ORS 136.260, requires that the court swear the original jury panel before it starts the selection of alternate jurors. Alternate jurors serve a very important part of the process, especially in trials of any length. People become ill, people get hung up by snowstorms, are unable to come to court, things happen. So by having alternates, we allow the system a way to have some resilience against those kinds of losses, and we allow the court prior to the beginning of deliberations to pick appointed alternate jurors. So the first part of Senate Bill 798 was not controversial. That was to simply allow courts the discretion to pick alternate jurors in a way that deviated from the statutory requirement that the panel be sworn. That's actually the practice by most judges around the state. The reason for that is the judges and the lawyers don't generally like to identify the alternates to the alternates, the theory being that we want everyone to pay the same attention, and the law requires we treat everybody the same, alternates and jurors, regular jurors anyway. So rather than tell them they're alternates, we generally don't tell them that to the end of the case. So the first half of that bill was going to allow that process, basically authorize what courts are doing right now. And I would ask you to modify this bill to make that change. The other part of Senate Bill 798 was essentially what you have now in proposed Senate Bill 931. And that was sent to a task force. There was some objection and controversy regarding granting the trial court's discretion to replace an alternate juror. I served on that task force along with others. That task force recommended that the proposal be modified to say that trial courts could substitute a juror with an alternate with the consent of the parties. And I agreed to that in an effort to try to get the bill forward, and I would urge you to amend the statute to add that provision. What the task force never was able to reach an agreement on is the question of when should that consent be given. I urge you to require that the parties consent at the beginning of the trial during jury selection, rather than waiting to the end of the trial. That's been my personal practice. I routinely get lawyers to agree to this kind of thing, and we do it on the front end. My concern with waiting to the back end would be to allow, would be that allowing, waiting, parties be influenced by their perceptions of how their trial went, how did the witness do, how did I do, those kinds of things. And on the front end, they're much more optimistic about the outcome of the case and how it's going to turn out, and more likely, I think, to get consent. The big goal here and the concern that I'm trying to address by allowing this substitution is the taxpayers of the state and the citizens of the state who serve on jurors, on juries, will sit through sometimes trials that last weeks, and they will have listened to every bit of the evidence. They will have been selected by the jurors, alternate jurors will have been selected by the parties, and then suddenly under the current law, what happens if we're required to discharge the alternates at the time the jury begins deliberations, and then if one of the jurors becomes sick, like just moments after that, and that has happened, then suddenly the choices the court are faced with is either saying to the parties, do you agree to go forward with less than 12 jurors, or less than six if it's a misdemeanor case, or alternatively, will you allow me to make that substitution? And if we can't, if they don't allow that substitution, then we have to go ahead and declare a mistrial. And that means all that effort has to start all over again. So from the perspective of taxpayer efficiency, my preference would be to allow the court the discretion to replace it. And this statute, the modification I'm suggesting to you, would allow that only with the consent of the parties on the front end. And that is a very big highlight of my testimony. I laid it out in more detail in my written testimony and explains the current process and how things work in more detail.
All right.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, Judge Znaczy, thank you very much. Let me just ask the panel if there's any questions from anyone here.
No questions.
All right. It doesn't look like we have any questions. What I'm going to do, it looks like I have one person that signed up to give testimony. You're more than welcome, if you have the time, to stay on the line to listen to the testimony, if you're not listening to it on air through the internet. And then we'll see where we go from there. So, Gil Myers, Gil, you're here to testify. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up on the sheet for Senate Bill 931? So while she's coming up, Michael, why don't you go ahead and give us the summary I didn't ask for at the very beginning.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 931 allows for the replacement of jurors discharged during trial or sentencing deliberations, so long as the jury begins their deliberations from the start. As Judge Znaczy said, we are waiting on two amendments.
All right. So, Gail, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Thank you. Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We did participate in the 2014 task force hosted by the Oregon State Bar in the aftermath of the 2013 original bill that Judge Znaczy referred to. And we were pleased with the outcome of the Oregon State Bar's proposal. That outcome proposed that the bill, the substitution of a juror in the middle of deliberations, and this is the thing that we do want to underscore, this is a jury now that has started to deliberate. This isn't in the middle of testimony. This is now in the course of their discussions, introducing a new person into those deliberations. What the Oregon State Bar's task force recommended was that substitution during deliberations could occur, but only upon consent of both of the parties, and or the parties could agree by consent to go to fewer than the mandatory number of jurors. You could agree to go to 11 or you could agree to have the substitution come in. The task force did not limit when this selection process had to occur. They were comfortable with the idea that the selection process, the decision point of whether to give consent or not, would happen at the time it was known that the substitution needed to occur. It was Judge Zanacci who felt strongly and was the minority voice in that vote that the timing of that selection process have to occur at the time of jury selection. So from the vantage point of trial lawyers, it is a huge consideration. If a jury's been deliberating 3 hours, that's a way different deal than if they've been deliberating 3 days. And you just can't know at the beginning of jury selection what this is going to look like. In our view, it is a perfectly legitimate consideration for a trial lawyer to say, I think this trial is going well, and I don't want to have it disturbed. And so those considerations of how the, I'm looking for some materials that I had saved here, just a second, considerations of how the trial is going and considerations of how a particular juror may or may not be affecting those deliberations, in our view, is a perfectly legitimate consideration for that lawyer to make in determining whether or not to consent to having a new juror enter those deliberations. By point of reference, I can refer to, admittedly, a different legal issue, but the issue of whether or not a trial court can declare a mistrial in the middle of trial over the objection of the defendant. And there's really strict requirements about that, and it ends up getting caught up in the double jeopardy clause. The defendant can get very attached to the jury in front of them and say, I do not want you to declare a mistrial over my objection. I want to go forward with this jury. Why? Because I like this jury. Why? Because I like the way the evidence has come in. And it's not always a foregone conclusion that the defense is well served by a mistrial or by substitution. Often, once you've rolled out your case, you've cross-examined the state's witnesses, you've given your opening, you don't want to do that twice. So the decision point that we feel strongly about, that the decision point of whether to decide to consent to introducing this new juror into the deliberations should not be at the front end of jury selection when you don't know anything yet. We feel strongly that decision point should be expected of the lawyer when the need arises, and how, so you can assess how long those deliberations have been going on and how that might impact the case.
All right, questions? So, Miguel, I've got a number of them, as you might imagine. I'm trying to figure out, what does it matter as to when we make that decision? And the perspective I'm hearing is that you believe that the attorney should have the ability to see how the jury perceive on their perspective as to how they might be answering those questions. To me, this is like jury shopping. It's basically waiting to see, well, you know, I think I've got a good case. Yeah, I like that juror over there. They seem to nod a lot. And so I think I want to go forward as compared to not. It doesn't make any sense to me that if we're going to have a procedure to have an alternative juror, that we would wait until all the cards have been put on the table, everyone gets to see how they think it's being deliberated, to make that decision, as compared to going in with blind justice, making sure everyone has an equal right, and saying yes or no. Personally, I'd like to just have the judges be able to make this decision as a matter of law. But I believe that the work group has reached a consensus that it should be by the consent of the parties. And so please, again, explain to me why we would want to have an attorney to be able to jury shop as it goes through that process to determine whether or not they want that jury to continue to deliberate.
Chair Prasonsky, that's part and parcel of what jury selection is. Right? Jury selection is part and parcel of taking a look and seeing As I understand the proposal is the decision has to be made even before jury selection starts. So it's just now your raw panel, your large panel, and you don't even know yet who's going to be in the 12th spot, let alone in the other two alternates. But that is part and parcel of the jury selection process, is to figure out how does this jury feel. I mean, that's what you're doing during jury selection. But then secondly, we do feel that this is a huge potential pivot. And it looks different after a few hours of deliberation than it does after 3 days. And to have waived your right to object, which is what this bill would say, you have no ability to object, really, if the court decides to introduce a new juror after 3 days of deliberations, because that choice point had been made way before anything was known. And we just think that that calculus is a very, very delicate one. We're not exactly sure how to articulate this, but this also interweaves, in our view, with non-unanimous jury verdicts. The federal system does allow for a court to introduce a juror during the course of deliberations, but of course in the federal system you've got a unanimous jury verdict. We're not sure what it means with a 10-2, but we think that we don't think that the corollary to the federal system is necessarily apropos. The other thing I was hoping to look up, and I wasn't able to do it right before the bill was called, on the civil side, these rules have been allowed, where the court can introduce I guess I'm answering my own question. I wanted to know what it looked like on the civil side. On the civil side, apparently it's left to the court, and so the parties don't need to give consent at the front end at all.
That's exactly right.
And
I think you made a good point, because that was my next point, is that the federal system allows this. So what I'm hearing is that potentially, if we modified it instead of being at the very beginning, at the time pre-jury selection, but post-jury selection, but prior to the trial starting, would you have the same position that you have now? The consent?
Chair Przonski, prior to the trial starting or prior to the jury deliberating?
Prior to the trial starting. Again, to me, this is jury shopping. From my perspective, if you can roll your case out and then have the option of saying yes or no at that point, I believe that you're really throwing a different decision into this process that I think our judicial system has never been geared to do, and that is like, we're going to give you a shot and let you see how you throw the dice, see if you think they're going to spin your way. You don't think they are. Or if you do, you know, you make your decision that way.
Chair Przonski, with respect to whether or not it's legitimate for the defendant to feel committed to a particular jury proceeding forward with their case, with respect to the issues of mistrials and manifest injustice, admittedly it's a different issue, but I'm just going to say that the courts have underscored that considering the importance to the defendant of being able once and for all to conclude his confrontation with the society through the verdict of the tribunal he might believe to be favorably disposed to his fate. So in the context of that issue, declaring mistrials over the objection of the accused, it's legitimate in the eyes of the U.S. Supreme Court for them to say, this is my jury, I'm resting and falling here. And so you can't get to that choice point if you're forced to make decisions before all is known.
Right.
One other thing. With respect to enhancement facts, under the guidelines, there's first a decision whether or not you're guilty of the charge, and then under the guidelines, if the district attorney has alleged enhancement facts that would aggravate the sentence beyond the typical guideline range, there's a separate jury trial on those enhancement facts. So you first have a trial on guilt, that same jury sits there, and then you have your trial on the enhancement facts. Right now it's a statutory requirement that with a 10-2 verdict, that the 10 jurors who found guilt have to be the same 10 jurors to find the enhancement.
Right
now our statutes do allow for substitution of an alternate before the enhancement trial begins. This would allow an introduction of an alternate juror once the jury is deliberating on the enhancement facts. Again, Mr. Chair, we think it gets complicated when you're talking about split 10-2 verdicts. It just gets very complicated.
All right, so that's another thing we can easily fix as to saying that if a jury is has gone to the deliberations, found guilt, and then they're going to an enhancement, that you'd have to have the same jury. I can potentially buy that, because I think that decision's now been made, and then you're going into whether or not those same people that found the person guilty should in fact have enhancements applied. That I can go with. But I want to get back to the point of on what rationale are we going to allow for consent at the end as compared to the beginning? I haven't heard an answer as to why you think that's, as a prosecutor for as many cases as I tried, it seems like everyone's on equal footing, and I can understand going through jury selection and saying, I feel pretty good or I don't feel pretty good about the selection. But it seems like at that point you need to make a decision. And I guess the other part to this is that if you do have a trial, let's just use a case of a murder trial, something that's going to take maybe weeks, maybe even months, that you've got it all the way through this process, and then basically someone gets sick, and it's determined that individual is not going to be able to continue as a juror. It's just like at that point, if you have an impaneled jury with an alternate there, that it would be reasonable to put that person into the mix to continue what they were already doing, taking all the evidence in and summarizing and going forward.
Chair Przonski, point well taken. We support the proposal from the Oregon State Bar Task Force, which would allow the introduction of an alternate during the course of deliberations if there's consent of the parties.
Any other questions? Senator Dimbrough.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. So the discussion so far has been, I think, at the graduate level or the law school level. I'm going to take it back to Judish 101 if we can. So remind me how this actually works. It's been a long time since I made it through voir dire and actually sat on a jury, but my understanding always was that that a couple more people than were needed were selected, sat through the whole trial, sat through the deliberations as well.
No.
For the deliberations, they have not been part of that, and so hence the difference here as to whether or not. What happens at that point? Do you want to redo the deliberations? Start from scratch or not?
Chair Przonski, Senator Dimbrough, these are great questions, and thank you. We're sorry we launched into graduate level stuff. Yes, normally in a 12-person jury, the court will usually select two alternates, could be more if it's going to be a long trial. And right now, I think that quite frankly, it varies from courtroom to courtroom whether the court pre-identifies those alternates versus just leaves them as a pool of 14 and then tells the two alternates they were alternates all along, they just didn't know that. The 12 then are sworn and to go in to deliberate. Right now the law says, our statutes read, that if in the course of a court can substitute an alternate because they've been sitting there the whole time in the middle of trial. What this bill presents is, what do you do once the jury starts to deliberate? There's 12 now in the room, they're deliberating. Let's assume one of them becomes ill and gets hospitalized. Right now the question is for the parties, does the defendant, usually it's the defendant's right to have a jury of 12, but do the parties agree to go with 11? Or do you want to have a mistrial declared? And so what the proposal is from the Oregon State Bar is, allow for there to be the introduction of one of the alternates into that existing deliberating jury with the consent of both parties, or allow the parties to go to 11. It would be an option. this is where, in our view, and this was a robust discussion in the task force, isn't the calculus different if the deliberations have only begun versus if they're stuck now for several days and it could be a murder case? The introduction of one new person could just be a huge pivot. And I think the task force felt it was a cleaner, simpler, and better verdict because you weren't going to have an appellate issue if this was done with the consent of the parties at the time.
Mr. Chair, this is Judge Zanashi. May I respond to a couple issues? I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm out of order here.
Currently, you are. If I could hold you in contempt, I would, but I won't. So we'll just hang on for a minute. We'll let Gail finish, and then we'll let you come back and
all right,
make
thank
statements.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was done with that answer. So.
All right. Judge Znache, go ahead and make your response.
There are just a couple of things I want to respond to. Is one, I want to urge you to be careful about changing the current law vis-a-vis the ability of alternate jurors to serve as decision makers in aggravating factors, or in the same rule applies actually to the penalty phase in death penalty cases. If you were to go back and say we're going to require it be the same 10 people who found guilt, that is going to lead to a lot of potential problems. The law does not require that either by statute or by constitution. Regularly, for instance, on a death penalty case, the case is sent out on appeal and something is found to be improper during the sentencing phase. Those matters are often tried with a whole new jury who didn't even hear the question of guilt, and that has been held constitutional. So I would urge you to go carefully into any kind of proposed change that would require the same 10 people who found guilt to be the people who make decisions on aggravating factors. The other thing I would like to say is this bill and any bill that gives the court the discretion doesn't mean the court necessarily is just going to do it. The defense argues, Ms. Myers, I apologize if I got your name wrong, ma'am. It says, well, what if it's days into the deliberations? That's certainly all this bill would do is give the court the discretion to do it. It doesn't require that, and the parties would certainly have a right to say, hey, Your Honor, we think deliberations have gone on too long. It would be unfair to substitute at this time. We don't think they're possible for them to start deliberations anew, and they may well convince the trial judge that that's the case. So we're not, I want to be clear, the statute doesn't require the trial judge to make that substitution. It just gives them the discretion. The parties would have an opportunity to explain why the court should not exercise that discretion. And that's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you. And just to take this back as to 101, so what the judge is saying is that if you actually have a case that juries found the person guilty, they find aggravating factors, or if there are aggravating factors, it then goes up on appeal. And at the point of the appeals court says, we think the individual was not proper, or the jury wasn't properly instructed. And then they're basically not going to bring back the original jury to have that question of the penalty. They will pick and select a new jury for that purpose of for resentencing. So that's the part there. Just make sure that's in there. So any other questions? All right, that's going to conclude our public testimony on Senate Bill 931. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And Judge Zanashi, thank you very much for making time in your day to be part of the process, and hope you have a good day.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
All right, let's see here. These three are yours. Do you have a preference of which one? All right, so thank you very much. What we're going to do is go ahead and go back to the top of the agenda. And we'll start with our other public hearings. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 132. And Josh, if you can give us the overview, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 132 makes a number of modifications to the statutory series applicable to defendants who are unable to aid and assist in their own defense. The bill prohibits the court from committing certain defendants to the state hospital under any circumstance and authorizes the superintendent of the state hospital to treat defendants in an outpatient capacity or in a facility other than the state hospital, including a correctional facility. The bill authorized the continued commitment of a defendant charged with murder on a maintenance hold, authorizes the court to order the involuntary medication of a defendant in the custody of the state superintendent, and finally, Senate Bill 132 clarifies that the statutory fitness process applies to violations of municipal ordinances, probation violations, and contempt allegations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So looks like we have three individuals that have signed up to give testimony today. I'm going to go ahead and ask Aaron and Allison to please come forward. I have Cheryl Ramirez after that. Is there anyone else besides these three that have signed up for Senate Bill 132?
All right. Good morning. Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director.
Chair Barker?
Chair Barker.
Oh.
Now,
oh.
In my defense, I remember in 2011, I called you, Chair Barker six times in one hearing when I was committee counsel.
Oh, you want to substitute chairs now, huh?
Yeah.
Right in the middle of the proceeding.
No. Is he available?
I don't know if that's discretionary or not.
What do we got? We got a coup going on here.
Yeah.
It's aggravating.
We're coming for you. All right, we're gonna just reboot here. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I hope I'm still Aaron Knott, the legislative director. I may be Aaron Knott unemployed for the Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 132. So Senate Bill 132 pertains to the processes by which a person is sent to the state hospital to aid and assist, to get capacity back to aid and assist in their own defense if they're facing criminal proceedings. Because of the scope of the liberty deprivation that goes into being sent to the state hospital against your will, this is a complicated statutory provision implicating state and federal constitutional interests. So the purpose of Senate Bill 132, this was in the run-up to this session, we realized that there were about seven of these bills modifying these provisions, and Chair Przanski, I may have referred to you as Chair Barker because most of them were in the House. We put Senate Bill 132 in to sort of serve as a backstop for those other bills to allow us to have some flexibility in approaching these issues, which are very technical. We pulled together a work group with, it was one of the biggest ones I've ever been on. It had the Oregon Health Authority, the State Hospital, Disability Rights Oregon, the district attorneys, the defense attorneys, the ACLU, the Association of Oregon Counties, the chiefs, the sheriffs, treatment providers, and others. The room was pretty much packed, and seeing that most of them are not here, I think we've pretty much reached consensus. Now, there is an amendment coming for this bill that's relatively substantial. It will not replace the bill, but it'll make mostly deletions, and I'll explain why momentarily. That amendment just, it's a tough time of year for LC. We didn't get it in as early as we had hoped to, so it's not ready, but I can testify to what will be in it. So as amended, first of all, what SB 132 will not do is, you heard Committee Counsel NASB make reference to changes to the way we treat municipal ordinances, probation violations, and contempt. We are removing those provisions. That was predominantly a fiscal decision. Those would either raise or lower certain bars on what type of case could get into the state hospital for treatment. The state hospital is very expensive and very crowded, and so in this budget environment, we decline to move forward with those proposals, and they will not be coming before you. So to talk about what remains in the bill, Senate Bill 132, in addition to making a series of sort of cleanup changes, primarily does three things. First of all, we're allowing a defendant to be treated somewhere other than the state hospital under limited circumstances. The process of being committed to the state hospital has two phases. The first one is the determination of whether you're presently able to aid and assist. Somebody, and it's often your defense attorney, because they're who's interacting with you, will make the observation that you don't seem to be understanding the nature of the proceedings against you. You can't talk to your attorney in a way that allows them to prepare a defense. So that'll trigger an evaluation done under 161.365. We've been striving over recent years to be more flexible in that evaluation, to try to meet the defendant wherever they are with whatever medical needs or safety needs that they present. Sometimes they're going to be in jail, sometimes they're going to be out in the community, and sometimes they're going to be at another facility like a hospital. Maybe they've checked themselves in, recognizing that they're in mental health crisis. So this bill allows more flexibility to have them evaluated where you find them with the consent of that facility, as long as it's being done in the best medical interests of that defendant. So it should provide good flexibility. After you are found unable to aid and assist, you are then typically moved to the state hospital. At that point, they treat you to restore you to capacity so that you're able to aid and assist and help your lawyer in preparing your defense. We have run into limited cases where a defendant who is already housed at the Department of Corrections, they're already serving a sentence, commits a new crime while they're in. And during that process, they're determined to be unable to aid and assist. That's a very rare fact pattern, but it has happened. And as you can imagine, that presents real safety issues for that person to be transferred to the state hospital, depending on what they're in for, what the new crime is. So similarly, we are putting in a provision that would allow a defendant to be treated at the Department of Corrections. But again, that's going to have to be in their medical interest and a determination of whether they pose a danger to themselves or others, justifying that. It won't be done as a matter of course. Next, we're attempting to address what I'll call a revolving door problem that happens on murders. Murders have a very long duration, and they're very complicated. The potential sentence is very long. The maximum possible sentence is quite high. And so it's not uncommon for us to encounter situations where a person who's charged with murder who has underlying aid and assist issues will be sent to the state hospital, they'll be treated, they'll be restored to competency, then they'll go back to jail pending trial, they'll start to deteriorate. The term we use is decompensate. They're not as compliant with their medication. The setting has changed. And the next thing you know, they are again unable to aid and assist. Then they are sent back to the state hospital to be treated again. And it's just sort of a revolving door. So we're looking to allow a year for what we're calling a maintenance hold, basically to give the state hospital heightened powers to continue to treat and work with somebody who's facing murder charges, to make sure that they don't decompensate in the pendency of trial and try to shut down that revolving door. Finally, this bill codifies a decision that was made in Sell versus United States by the United States Supreme Court and has already been interpreted in Oregon case law in a case called State v. Lopes, which governs involuntary medication. And all we're doing with this provision is taking the case law and trying to codify it in statute word for word. The reason we're doing this, and I think we've got the consent of everybody in the task force that we've given word for word our best shot, is because the process for administering involuntary medication is even more complicated, and the findings that need to be made much higher than just sending one to the state hospital. And that makes sense. You're medicating someone against their will, so you have to make extensive judicial findings that it's in their best clinical interest, that it'll succeed in restoring them to competency, that there's an important governmental interest at stake. And if any of these findings are made incorrectly or incompletely, if the case goes up on appeal, it can easily be sent back to the trial court for further findings. That's not great for the person who's facing involuntary medication. We want to do everything we can to help our judges get this right the first time, because as soon as that order goes in, you have somebody potentially being involuntarily medicated or months going by while you try to resolve it on appeal. Again, we're not moving the needle on policy. That was just to give guidance to judges, and we hope we've done so. We had the Judicial Department and others related to that issue sitting with us when we put it together. So then there are a number of smaller sort of technical tweaks with language that we don't believe are highly substantive. So that's your sort of flyover version. Again, I'm optimistic that when the amendments come in, they will be consensus amendments and we can move that thing along.
All right, thank you. And Allison, are you also going to give testimony? You're here as the lifeline.
The latter.
Okay.
All right, you didn't save him, though, when he said Chair Barker, so we'll just keep that on the record, too.
And Chair...
You're on your own on that one, Aaron.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is why I brought her along, and I'll be talking to her later.
All right. Thank you all both for being here. Any questions for
I do have a question,
Senator Dimbrough?
What ability does the defendant have to seek a change in the decision, right? I mean... Can a defendant, request to be deemed competent at any point in the state, in the process, or is it always other people who are making this decision?
Do you want to take that?
Do you see what I'm asking?
Are you taking the points?
So, Chair Przanski and Senator Dimbrough, in this process. Especially under ORS 161 through 65, there is the option for defense counsel on behalf of the defendant to submit an examination using a certified evaluator of their choice. So that would be an opportunity for them to put forth information at their option.
And Allison, I need you to put your full name on the record, please.
Sorry about that. My name is Allison Banworth, Assistant Attorney General for the Oregon Department of Justice General Counsel Division.
Thank you. Other questions or follow-up, Senator Lithicum?
Just a cross-check. It sounded like as you were describing the maintenance hold, for example, in a murder, as I looked at that section, the if clause, that is, it must be, it's way down in section 3, subpart 4A or something like that. On page 5, it looks like it's a 180-day revolving door, fitness to proceed within 100 days and check back every 180 days one after. In your testimony, you made it sound like it was a one-year item. And this looks like it's 180, 180, 180, 180, potentially.
That's, we put that in.
And if I'm in the wrong place, please correct me.
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, the one-year cap on the maintenance hold was discussed in the work group and added by amendment. It does not appear in the base bill, okay. Which is why you are not seeing that language.
Thank you.
Right. Any other questions? Catch and clarification? All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. We have Cheryl Ramirez, and as Cheryl's coming up, I see it's checked neutral, and it says until amendments are included. So we have a segue, right? Maybe we're going that way once we get to see whatever the amendments are?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, yes, that's accurate. Right. And we've seen the amendments. We've seen the outline that Mr. Knott provided to you. So, first of all, I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. We represent the community mental health programs who are the lead in the community mental health system in working with aid and assist defendants. So that's why I'm here. We would support the amendment as outlined by Mr. Knott, assuming there are sufficient resources dedicated to communities to provide appropriate restoration services in the communities for the people with these minor charges that were mentioned. As the governor's budget notes, a robust array of community services is key to the success in addressing the overpopulation of aid and assist defendants at the state hospital. We were one of the groups that was concerned about a potential broad interpretation of another facility or other facility that could mean a lot of things. And so with the clarifications that Mr. Knott mentioned, that alleviated our concerns. So we're good with that. We would suggest one very small minor change in section 2, I believe. I can't remember exactly where it was. The reference was to a community mental health provider. We would change that to the community mental health program to align with the consultation role of the community mental health program in the statute. And although it's not a point of this bill, I just want to mention that House Bill 2420 passed in 2015 to require courts to order the CMHP to consult with the aid and assist defendant prior to sending to Oregon State Hospital. This has resulted in improved collaboration and communication among the community mental health system, the judiciary system, public safety, and along with targeted investment in community restoration, the aid and assist numbers have actually lowered at the state hospital. So we have made progress, and I think we will continue making progress with these investments and with the improved collaboration among the systems. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony.
All right, thank you. Questions? Cheryl, I have one question. Mm-hmm. The community provider is, from my understanding, is normally the county mental health department or something in that configuration. Is that a fair description?
It's the community. It should be the community mental health program, and that is the county-based community mental health system. It may be with the county department. It may be a not-for-profit, but it is the county-based system.
All right, and with that on the record, if you have a case that's in a municipal court and they have an individual that seems not to be fit to proceed, I would assume that they would also be forward it or sent through the community program, and they would not be going to the state hospital. They first would be going through the local provider to determine what is going to happen next.
Chair Przanski, that is how it is supposed to work, yes.
Okay, supposed to work. I appreciate that.
Not in all cases.
It doesn't always do, yeah.
Yes.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 132? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 132. And we will open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 298. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 298 makes permanent provision granting BOLI commissioner discretion to seek civil penalties or appear in court on housing discrimination claims.
All right, thank you. So on 298, we have Paloma Sparks and Amy Claire. If y'all two would come forward as you're coming forward. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 298? Paloma, are you going to start or is Amy?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 298 this morning. As you know, the Bureau enforces anti-discrimination laws that apply to workplaces, housing, and public accommodation. The Bureau investigates and prosecutes complaints regarding alleged discrimination practices in housing throughout the state. In 2015, we pursued legislation to give us some discretion in how we handle housing cases. Prior to 2015, the law required that if somebody filed a housing discrimination complaint with us and we had found that there was substantial evidence of a violation, if they chose to then remove their case from our administrative process and file in civil court, the Bureau was required to continue to represent those complainants. And that was costing us quite a bit. Some of these trials can be quite costly. We rely on DOJ to represent us anytime we're in civil court. So in 2015, the legislation was passed, but with a limited operational date, so it only lasted for 2 years. We would like to make that change permanent. The 18 cases, I believe, have elected, and we have used...
Cost cases, never mind.
Ms. Claire may clarify some of these numbers for me. And we have used our discretion, I believe, 3 times. So when the Bureau receives a housing complaint, our investigators analyze the documents, interview the parties, and make a determination as to whether there's evidence to show a violation of civil rights law. Where investigators find sufficient evidence of unlawful discrimination, we pursue remedies for the injured party through settlement or the administrative hearing process. Again, individuals are welcome to file in civil court. This change that we received under Senate Bill 380 in 2015 simply gives us some discretion about whether or not we continue to pursue that case once it has removed to civil court. That is consistent with how we handle employment discrimination cases and how we handle public accommodation discrimination cases. Part of the reason why the law was structured the way it was prior to 2015 is was a requirement of the Housing and Urban Development in order to be considered substantially equivalent with federal law. We were required to have the requirement that we would continue to pursue a case if somebody elected to go to civil court. That was a requirement so we could have a contract with HUD. We no longer have a contract with HUD. HUD did not pay us for our actual costs. They pay a limited amount on per case basis, and they don't reimburse for litigation costs. Given the current state of what the HUD budget is going to look like, we're not interested in pursuing that contract again, but we are aggressively enforcing housing discrimination under state law. So with that, I would just say that there are times when it is important for us to have some prosecutorial discretion and determining how best to spend taxpayer dollars, and that is why we've pursued this legislation.
All right, thank you. Amy, were you making comments as well?
For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Since the passage of Senate Bill 380, we've had 18 cases where we found substantial evidence of an unlawful act. And currently, three of those are in settlement discussions. There have been two administrative closures. Several withdrew to court, and we were able to settle six of the cases. We have referred two cases since the passage of Senate Bill 380 to the Department of Justice, where we will incur the cost to litigate on behalf of the complainants. I think it's important to point out, and Paloma did mention in her testimony, that in virtually all other types of cases filed with us, we have discretion whether or not to issue formal charges or the parties can go to court at any time. The difference here with the housing cases that HUD required is that we would have to pay the cost of litigation. Under the Fair Housing Assistance Program, which is called FAP, fellow agencies similar to BOLI that have, I surveyed many of them trying to find out how they handle this. A number of them are fortunate enough to have in-house counsel where we're not allowed to have that. And a neighboring state confessed to me that they reversed the findings on 20 cases to avoid paying the cost of litigation, and that would be an untenable situation for us at BOLI. All right.
Question, Senator Dembro first.
Thanks. So as I recall the legislation from 2 years ago, there was discussion of if BOLI chose not to to defend, to do the case, it would be referred to HUD, right? And has that happened? I'm just wondering how this has been playing out.
Chair Przonski, Senator Dembro, the change that would be, since we no longer have a HUD contract, if somebody wanted to file under federal law, they have to file directly with HUD. Largely what's happening is that individuals are filing directly with HUD and also with BOLI under state law, because the state law is more protective than federal law. So anybody can still file under state law, and we can take their complaint and investigate it.
Okay. So just to follow up, those who have filed under federal law, do you know how those cases have gone over the last 2 years?
I don't have any data on the resolution from HUD.
All right, Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here this morning. Excuse me. I don't have any confidence in the new director of HUD at the federal level, so I think that this is important. So what we have here now is BOLI has this temporary authority to use this discretion, and now this bill is asking to make this discretion permanent. Is that the purpose of this bill?
Chair Prezonsky, Senator Manning, that's correct.
Okay.
All right, any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298. And what I want to do is I'm going to open up just for the purpose where we can have a little discussion, because I want a little guidance from the committee, a work session on 298 for just the discussion. As presented to us, this is to make permanent what we had done a few years back as to giving an opportunity for seeing how this was going to work through BOLI, and whether or not at this point we want to make this permanent or not. And I'm just going to ask my colleagues as to where you're at now, so we kind of know where we might want to go or need to go for a work session. Senator Manning?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that this is, you know, again, as I expressed earlier, I am not confident at the federal level the new director of HUD is going to be viable to anybody. And I think that we need to have this in place, at least at the state level. BOLI has been doing a great job, and it just gives them the discretion. It doesn't say that they're going to go out and do anything, but we need to have some kind of support that's going to identify and going to work with people that are succumb to these types of treatment. I think it's a good bill, and I do support it.
All right. Does anyone else want to make any comments? The question really for Chair is, do we want to make this permanent at this point? Do we have enough information from the past record as to what has happened at this point, or do we want to consider some other alternative than permanency?
I would suggest we don't really have enough data. I see Paloma's testimony here, and there's a few facts and figures. There's tons of information with regard to SB 380 and those kinds of things. I would like more time to deliberate. Right now, I'm feeling like this. Anytime we give this discretion, we're opening up a can of worms at the departmental level.
All right. Any other comments? Senator Devereaux.
You know, I guess the alternative would be to maybe extend the authority for a period of time. I was thinking 4 years to. We, you know, I share Senator Manning's concern about where HUD is going now.
Yeah.
In about 4 years, we might have a better sense. I think I would be willing to support that.
That's why I really wanted to open this up, because I was kind of going both ways as to whether make it permanent or should we extend the sunset out for some time in the future. So I've gotten some guidance. Senator Thatcher, did you want to make any comments?
Well, I just remember this was in the Workforce Committee in 2015 and seemed to make sense at that time. And there were some other issues surrounding whether they would be substantially in compliance with the federal thing. I don't quite remember all the details, but it does make sense to have some sort of sunset still. I'm not comfortable with just lifting it.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got some guidance here, so I'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 298. We'll get some amendments drafted for that bill before we bring it back. Now, we have another bill for public testimony today, which is Senate Bill 528. One of our presenters is in another committee, so what I'm going to do is we'll come back to that. I'd like to go ahead and do the work sessions that we have scheduled for today. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 249. And Josh, if you can give us an overview summary on this again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 249 authorizes a person to file a motion vacating a conviction for prostitution if the person was a victim of sex trafficking. There's a -1 amendment before the committee today that makes three changes to the introduced bill. The -1 requires the movement to wait at least 21 days after judgment to file the motion. It limits the ability of the court to grant the motion to circumstances in which the defendant was a victim of sex trafficking at or around the time of the prostitution conviction. And it modifies the definition of sex trafficking. Senate Bill 249 with the -1 amendment has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, so colleagues, if we're going to move this forward, the chair would recommend that we do the amendment of the -1s. It looks like this will be a straight vote to the floor. So, Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment, so I don't know the date, but to Senate Bill 249.
Senator Thatcher moves the -1 amendments for Senate Bill 249 into the bill. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
No.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 249 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 249 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I believe this is one of the bills that Senator Taylor brought forward, and if it is, we're going to go ahead and allow her or ask her to be the carrier on 249. We'll close the work session on 249, and we'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 250.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 250 creates an affirmative defense to the crime of prostitution for persons who were victim of sex trafficking. Senate Bill 250 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, and this looks like no amendments and to the floor. So, Senator Thatcher?
Chair Brzozinski, I move Senate Bill 250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And again, I believe Senator Taylor was the primary sponsor, so we'll assign this to her as well. We'll close the work session on 250, and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 375.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 375 authorizes nonprofit organizations to provide sex trafficking materials for distribution at roadside rest areas. Senate Bill 375 has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, but it also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. So, Senator Thatcher?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we have to go to Ways and Means, and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thanks.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just have a question about the subsequent referral. I didn't look at the fiscal. Where does the fiscal come from if the material is being prepared by nonprofits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, the fiscal is actually on OLIS. I think the short version is there's no fiscal, but there's an anticipation that these materials will need to be cleaned up from the roadside rest areas.
All right. So, in other words, we have volunteers putting them up. But at some point they may need to be taken down, and that would be potentially a cost.
Boy, that seems like it should be a minimal cost.
It also seems like that would be with the whoever, I forget what the name of the entity is that's actually doing the
Oregon transportation. I mean tourism.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's under contract.
Maybe. Can Amy, is it?
Amy is not here. Oh, there she is. Oh, she's in the back. I was waiting for her to come get in for the other one. Please come forward.
Sorry, Amy.
No, that's good. Out her because I was waiting to see for 528. When you're in the back pew there, it's hard to see you.
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. This is not a bill that I, from my office, was paying attention to, so I'm not familiar with whether ODOT submitted a fiscal or not. What I can tell you, in the world of roadside rest areas, there are two entities involved. ODOT does the maintenance and upkeep on some of them, but many of them over the last couple of years have been transferred to the Travel Information Council, also known as Oregon Travel Experience. So I don't know who submitted a fiscal or what that would be for. I can certainly follow up after committee and get you any information you'd like.
I appreciate that, but I don't think we're going to move the bill. And I think what we could do is we could ask for the subsequent to be removed if the committee would like to do that, just to see how the president's office responds. And it's like we have consensus to that. So, Amy, why don't you just stay there because we're going to start with the other one. So at this point, I would ask Senator Thatcher if she would like to amend her motion to include a request that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be removed by the President's office.
Okay. Chair Brzozinski, I amend my previous motion to request that the Senate President's office evaluate whether it needs to be sent to Ways and Means.
All right. So at this point, the motion that's before us is to pass Senate Bill 375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, understanding that it now has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but asking the President's office to reconsider whether it still needs to go to Ways and Means. So we'll have a little extra paperwork for the chair to be signing. But any discussion?
The only thing in the fiscal, as was mentioned, it's the potential for cleanup, the threat of vandalism and, what do they actually say? High targets of vandalism. This bill could increase the rate of damage, defacement, et cetera. Those kinds of things are the things to consider. With regard to this, it probably I concur with the idea of sending it without the further recommendation, but that's just something for everybody to weigh.
A lifeline has run into the hearing here. So other comments after you catch your breath and put your name on the record.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Leah Horner with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I apologize for being so out of shape.
We can take care of that. We've got a training program.
Okay, good. I got a text message that this was having discussion and that my poor Amy got pulled up here. But I believe the question was around the fiscal and the referral to Ways and Means. I think we, as an agency, have worked closely with the proponents of the bill and the other agencies involved to really look at other opportunities that there are about doing the work through volunteer programs. And I think that we came forward with a no fiscal on it because of that. And I think that we would be more than happy to work with what other agencies to ensure that that's done appropriately.
All right, thank you. Any other follow-up? Thank you for running up here, literally. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and let y'all step back. Well, Amy, you'll stay there, please. All right, at this point, we do have a motion before us. Is there any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. And if the subsequent is removed by the president's office, I'm going to ask Senator Hansel to be the carrier, since I believe he was the first presenter. I know there's a couple of chief sponsors besides him, but I know he asked me about this, so we'll ask Hansel to carry. So that we're going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 375. And at this point, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 528. Josh, if you can give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 528 eliminates the authority of the Department of Transportation to reinstate a person's driver license 15 years after conviction for driving while under the influence of intoxicants. And the bill also extends the period of time through which a temporary permit remains valid following an arrest for driving while under the influence of intoxicants. All right. Thank you.
I'm going to ask Brad Craig if you'll please come forward, since you're a proponent for the bill and Amy is here in a neutral position for ODOT. While Mr. Craig's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 528? All right. Mr. Craig, I'm not sure if you've given testimony before, but if you'll give us your name first and then your testimony, it'd be appreciated.
Good morning to you all. My name is Brad Craig. I reside in Corvallis, Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 528, what I'd like to see changed is from basically a 12-hour waiting period after you've been issued a citation, possibly have spent the night in jail, to go to pick up your vehicle the next day. And the reason I would like to see this changed is that after a heavy night of drinking and your BAC has been 0.19, 0.20, 0.25, that's quite an extreme night of drinking. And the human body takes time to process alcohol. So kind of the rule of thumb is, and the common knowledge is that, well, I'm out partying, having a good time, I know I've had a lot to drink, and I'm gonna sleep it off. So they get up the next morning at 6 after going to bed at midnight, or they get up at 8 in the morning after staying out to 3 in the morning. Oh, I slept it off, took a shower, and had something to eat. Many, many, many times that person or persons are still heavily under the influence. They may look sober, they may smell good after a shower, but they can still fail a breathalyzer test. And I know from my personal experience, but I have had friends do what I just described, and the next day they're going to work or down to the mall shopping, and they get pulled over for a taillight, not using the blinker. And the officer would say, well, your eyes look kind of red. You look kind of tired. What's going on here? And sometimes, not all the times, but mouthwash doesn't work. And you'll get that funky little smell that you've been drinking. And so that is probable cause. Well, I'm going to have to give you a breathalyzer. And they fail. And they're arrested for DUI the following day after supposedly sleeping it off. Well, if you have a 24-hour waiting period, that would become hopefully common knowledge, that your body can process the alcohol better, and you most likely will never have that situation where you're going to sleep it off just for a few hours or even 8 hours, and that you're in that getting a DUI the next day hopefully would be almost eliminated from our society.
All right. So, Mr. Craig, it seems that you're asking the committee to include or add something to the existing bill as to a wait period, a longer wait period or additional time before they would be able, an individual who's been charged would be going in, or is 24? Okay. I apologize. I was looking at the catch line and didn't see this section 2. So is your position is that it should stay at 12, or do you think it should go to 24?
I believe it should go to 24.
Okay.
Hours.
All right. Okay, thank you for the clarification. Questions for Amy, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I'm going to be speaking to a different part of the bill than what the other witness testified to. This is regarding the effectively a 15-year sort of statute of limitations on the treatment requirement. So under existing law, when a person's convicted of DUII, to regain their driver license, they have to do a number of things, and one of those is to show proof to the DMV that they have completed alcohol or drug treatment, and that treatment has to be a certified program through the Oregon Health Authority. So up until 2013, that was the only method to demonstrate that you'd completed treatment, was to show this proof. If a person had, for example, completed a treatment program that wasn't certified by the Oregon Health Authority, maybe they did AA, maybe they did a program outside of the state. If somebody is a visitor from the state, gets a DUI and completes treatment outside of the state, a number of things could happen where they completed treatment and it wasn't certified. That was not acceptable proof. The person might have completed treatment 10, 15, 20 years ago through a certified program, but that program is now out of business, moved on. And our information was that Oregon Health Authority only keeps records for 7 years and courts for about 10 years, so the person might not have that proof anymore. The other kind of situation is the person just over the passage of time believes they shouldn't have to complete treatment anymore. And so the situation that was happening was folks were coming into the DMV wanting to be reinstated, and under some of these situations, really the only option was to go back and take Oregon Health Authority approved treatment. So in 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 2121, which did two things. One of them is it provided a method for the individual to go to court in the county where they'd been convicted and sort of show proof to the judge that based on whatever their circumstances were, that they'd sort of substantially complied with the treatment requirement under law, get a court order, and then take that to DMV, and that satisfied the requirement. The other thing that was put into House Bill 2121 in 2013 was this sort of 15-year statute of limitations. Basically, after the passage of 15 years, the requirement simply isn't there anymore. I will say that it's an odd bit, I think, in there, and why 15 years? Well, the reason for 15 years is because it syncs up with current law regarding DUIs and diversions. So if you get convicted of a DUI, you're not eligible for diversion until 15 years has passed, and now the court may authorize a diversion after a DUI conviction 15 years before. So the idea, I believe, in 2013 was to sync those two things up. So I'm just here to provide that information about where this law comes from and answer any questions you have about that process.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Lithicum first.
Could you explain some background about the DUI and diversion? How does that work? You said you, with regard to the 15-year sinking, I'm not being unfamiliar. I'm just curious for some background.
So just the general concept?
Yeah, just general concept. What diversion?
I'm in.
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum, I'll do my best. So under Oregon law, if generally for your first offense of DUII, provided there aren't some extenuating circumstances, I believe you qualify for a diversion program, which involves a brief license suspension requirement that you install an ignition interlock device in your car, which means you can't start your car if your BAC is over minimal amounts. Abstinence from alcohol, treatment requirements, victim impact panels, any number of requirements, and then at the conclusion of, I believe it's typically 1 year, if you've complied with everything, the DUI converts to a diversion. It stays on your record, but it is not technically a conviction for DUII. Then if you have a subsequent DUI ticket, you're no longer eligible for diversion. You get a conviction, which has different consequences. And then what I was describing is after 15 years, after your first a conviction of DUII, you sort of reestablish eligibility for diversion.
Reset.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just to give you a little bit more clarity on that. So if you're eligible for the diversion program and if you enter it, you swear that you've not been either convicted either in this state or another state of a similar type of charge, or that you have not gone through an alcohol diverted type program. And on your driver's license printout, it has an initials DIVR for diversion. So not only can you reset based on a conviction after 15 years, if you've had a diversion and you were successful and you have no other say situations that you come before the law enforcement and get cited again, and 20 years has passed, or at least 15 years has passed, then you can actually apply for diversion again. So it's a reset after 15 years. This legislature, it used to be 10 years, and we moved it from 10 years to 15 years, and that's basically where we're at on a, what was, I guess I'm going to say, it was a policy decision. Okay. All right. Okay, and see, the other part, I guess I just want to put on the record now that I'm reading Section 2. Currently, when an officer cites an individual for DUII, they will give them a temporary permit. This temporary permit is really in effect for 30 days, but there's a wait period before you can actually use it or not be in violation, and that's currently 12 hours. And what we're saying is that The proposal is to move it to 24 hours before you would be able to start driving a vehicle. And it doesn't matter whether your vehicle was towed or if it was parked legally on the side of the road, you still wouldn't be able to operate any motor vehicle within what would be a 24-hour period than a 12-hour period. That's the way I'm taking this in. And it does look like the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII and their letter of support does, in fact, address both of those. So, and Amy, I believe you sit in on that advisory group.
Chair Przanski, I attend that group when I can. I am not a member of that group, but our safety division staffs that group, so we have many touch points with the governor's advisory committee on DUII.
All right. So the only other thing I guess I would just put on the record is that everyone would be processed the same. The question would be, if by going from 12 hours to 24 hours, if a vehicle has been towed, there would be an additional cost to the individual. I guess not. I think you could probably still get the vehicle out. It just, they wouldn't be able to drive it. They'd have to have someone else to drive it. So I think there would be a way that they could actually not incur those extra costs. Any other comments or questions? All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and thank you all, and Mr. Craig, thank you for coming forward to give your testimony today. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 528. My understanding is that none of the bills that we did for public hearing today were ready to move forward, and so we will reassess as we get paperwork in and moving bills forward from there. With that, I believe that takes care of everything else we had on our agenda since we've taken care of the work sessions. And if that's the case, then I'm going to go ahead and close the committee till for today, and we'll be back here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. We're adjourned. Here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. We're adjourned.